Verna Root and I are children of a so-called privileged mixed marriage. Privileged here means that the Jewish part of the mixed marriage was protected by the non-Jewish part. But the Nuremberg laws classified us as Geltungsjuden, valid Jews. We were treated as valid Jews because we were members of the Jewish community and went to school in the Jewish children's home. Our education and connection to the Jewish community made us just like children with four Jewish grandparents. So we had to wear the star, we couldn't take the tram, I couldn't go to school, etc. But the most important thing was that, to begin with, we weren't deported. Mixed marriage Jews in the German Reich weren't deported to Theresienstadt until late 1944, early 1945. By not getting divorced, our father saved our lives. It simply didn't cross his mind to abandon us. He was a confirmed communist. Human values and solidarity were paramount for him.
Our father was locked up here in Munich at Ettstraße in 1933-1934. He was a communist, a member of the Rote Hilfe, and married to a Jewish woman. Both of them were members of the Rote Hilfe. I have a document here dated October 7th, 1933. Confidential. Clementine Grube, born August 28th, 1903, among others, has been identified as a member of the Rote Hilfe. Father was sent to a forced labor camp in Thuringia. He was released after a while because he had gastric ulcers. He fought against Hitler in his own way, refusing to get divorced. There were very few who held out, with three children and almost no ration cards.
He was in the army until 1941 in the campaign against France. But then he learned that so-called Jüdisch Versippte, those related to a Jew by marriage, weren't permitted to wear the Führer's garment of honor. So he immediately reported that his wife was Jewish and was dismissed from the army in fall 1941. We were lucky, of course, because then he was here with us the whole time in Munich. We lived next door to the synagogue in Herzog-Max-Straße, in a house that belonged to the Jewish community. Of the three buildings in Herzog-Max-Straße, two were rented out, and the Jewish community administration was in the other. Across the yard at the back was a sort of depot for second-hand goods, toys, clothing, crockery, where needy Jews could find things. It needs to be said because whenever people talk of Aryanization, they mean the Jews with property, the wealthy ones, not those who were poor. And after Aryanization and the race laws, everyone who was still here was suddenly penniless. That's why it was so important that there was a Jewish welfare office. It set up apprentice workshops where Jewish youths could learn a trade. The children's home was also set up by welfare, and also this depot.
We were repeatedly told that the proximity of our main Munich synagogue to the Künstlerhaus in Herzog-Max-Straße displeased the Führer, Hitler. On June 8, 1938, I addressed the committee of the German Association of Rabbis. During the meeting, I was called to the Ministry of the Interior. The previous evening, Hitler had attended some festivity or other at the Künstlerhaus. The ministry spokesman informed me that the synagogue was considered a traffic obstruction and was to be demolished the next day. I objected that there was virtually no traffic there and that the synagogue, with the Frauenkirche in the background, was a notable city landmark. The demolition of the synagogue by the construction firm Moll was to begin on the following day and to be finished by July 9th, the Day of German Art. In the afternoon, deeply moved, the entire community gathered in the synagogue with Dr. Beerwald and a number of other rabbis. The prayer Avinu Malkenu, our Father, our King, was spoken, a final Kaddish, and the Torah rolls were conveyed in solemn procession to the administrative building. The next day, demolition of the synagogue began. I stood on the steps of the administrative building with our chief cantor, Professor Kirschner, and watched the work of destruction.
The old St. Matthew's Church stood in the middle of Sonnenstraße, where Schwanthaler Straße meets Sonnenstraße. St. Matthew's was close to the junction. It was a very pretty neoclassical church, the first evangelical church in Bavaria, the evangelical cathedral. Gauleiter Wagner had gotten it into his head that the subway had to be built there, so the church had to come down. There was this big plan to redesign Munich with parade squares. The subway was intended to get the people to the squares. Part of the subway under Königsplatz and Lindwurmstraße was actually built. I was there on the evening of the farewell service. Columns of police and SA stood in readiness in Schwanthaler Straße and Landwehrstraße so that demolition could begin on time. They were afraid that there would be demonstrations, and there were. This was in 1938. The congregation inside the church sang the whole evening. People simply wouldn't go. They stayed and sang "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." It was midnight before anyone left. Demolition work began immediately. By the next morning, the roof had gone.
Then, on June 8th, 1938, we stood there as the main synagogue in Herzog-Max-Straße was demolished. That was bad. An experience you simply can't forget. The evening or a few days before, there had been a big conference of rabbis. The last rabbis in Germany. There were a good many in the Israelite community rooms in Munich under the chairmanship of Dr. Leo Beck. The Israelite community was told more or less overnight that the synagogue was to be torn down. There's a legend, it may or may not be true, that Hitler came down Prinzregentenstraße and drove past the synagogue asking, "What's that building there?" "That's the Jewish synagogue, my Führer." According to the legend, it may or may not be true, Hitler simply said, "Tear it down." Just like that. A magnificent synagogue. The community was allowed to rescue the Torah rolls. On June 7th, a final service was held there. The cantor Emanuel Kirschner had a God-given voice. He lived round the corner from us in Kunigundenstraße. It was a privilege to visit him on Sabbath afternoons. It was something special to be invited. He sang the prayer of a suffering man when he gives up hope. Mole Rachamim. It still gives me goosebumps today when I think of it. He was already past 80 and sang one last time after a long period of retirement with, as he said, a broken heart. Something like that just knocks you over. You have to be made of stone for it not to. But what's the point? We've lost all that. I still see us all standing there, all the rabbis, and all of us too. It had evidently been announced that the synagogue was to be demolished. And then the wrecking ball swung. It made a squeaking, grating noise. We Jews stood there, tears in our eyes, while a crowd of onlookers jeered excitedly and clapped. Can you believe it?
On Hitler's personal instruction, the Leonhard Moll Construction Company demolished the third largest synagogue in the German Reich. It was the prelude to the physical annihilation of the German Jews. We lived here in house number 3. In June, the synagogue was torn down, the houses became the property of the city of Munich, and on July 1st, we were given notice. On July 3rd, our sister was born here at number 3. Number 5 was also lived in, and number 7 was the Jewish community offices. The caretaker and his wife, the Goldlusts, lived there. Like many other Munich men, Herr Goldlust was arrested in the pogrom night and taken to Dachau. But before they took him to Dachau, they tortured him. They hung him on a wrought iron gate here between number 7 and number 5 and cut him down before he was dead. Then they drove him to Dachau. At some point, they released him on condition that he leave Germany. He had to sign to it. He didn't know where to go. Somehow he went into hiding. He was found, arrested, and sent to Buchenwald, where he was murdered on December 8th, 1939. Frau Goldlust lived in Munich in mass accommodation for Jews at Lindwurmstrasse 125 until 1942. She was then taken to Theresienstadt, where she was murdered in 1944, on April 24th. Herr Goldlust is inseparably connected with when we lived in these houses, especially for my brother and me. After the synagogue had been torn down, we were the only family left living here, with no light, no gas, no running water, and it was Herr Goldlust who never failed to help us and who we always fetched water from. It was a residential area then. Now no one lives here. I don't come here anymore either. There's no one left who has the same connection I have with this street. Every year, the names of the murdered were read out at this square, even after Karstadt built their department store. I found it unbearable to see the people going in and out of the store. They go in empty-handed and come out carrying bags, while I stand there and read out the names. I stopped going.
When the synagogue at Herzog Maxstrasse was demolished, the neighboring tenements belonging to the Israelite community were confiscated. On June 1, 1938, all tenants, with the exception of us, were given notice. Father tried to get the city of Munich to allocate us another apartment, but they refused. The municipal authorities referred us to the Israelite community, a joke. First they take away the buildings from the community, and then they're meant to find apartments for their tenants. We stayed in the apartment until November 7, 1938. There was no lighting, no water, no gas. Everything had been cut off. Our mother cooked on the wood stove in the kitchen by candlelight. Then we were evicted. Our parents had no alternative but to put us in the children's home in Antonienstrasse in Schwabing. We were in this home for almost 4 years, till early 1942. To begin with, there were 46 or 48 children of different ages, from babies to 14 years old. My sister Ruth was the youngest. 4 months old, born on July 8, 1938, she entered the children's home on November 8, 1938. Life in the home was just fantastic. There was a garden, an orchard. It was in the children's home I learned to ride a bike. The home was excellently run. We celebrated the Jewish festivals for the first time here. We hadn't done that at home. I remember crawling under the table when Nikolaus came in. There used to be a grocery store where the school is today. Youth stood around and made fun of us or spat at us. There were fights. When we went out, we would experience these hostilities. I didn't find it easy to come to terms with. I didn't see what they had against us. The home was like a refuge. It had been set up by the Jewish Welfare Office in 1926 as a normal component of the social fabric. Things changed with Hitler's takeover and the growing exclusion, defamation, and discrimination of Munich's Jewish citizens. There were also children, two 13-year-old boys in the house next to the home. They came round to us because there were lots of toys and a beautiful garden. In September 1941, we were obliged to wear the yellow star. We sat in the garden, sewing the star onto every piece of clothing, and they threw stones over at us. The whole neighborhood was against us now. It was a situation that led to regular conflict with neighboring children and passers-by. We were abused verbally, called Jewish swine, or passers-by changed to the other side of the street when they saw us. When Father was still in the army, he occasionally visited us at the home in his uniform. Once in October 1941, he went for a walk with my brother and me. We had to wear the star, and we went to a cafe at Danziger Freiheit, Münchner Freiheit today. We were wearing our stars, he in his uniform, and they refused to serve us. So he said, "I shall be served, and I shall only leave here when I and my children have been served." And then they served us. That was Franz Grube, painter, decorator, dogged and firm. Until then, we'd gone to the Jewish school by tram. Now that was forbidden. So we walked to school every day, 3.5 kilometers each way. I started going to school in 1937, and by that time already, Jewish children had to go to a Jewish school.
In summer 1936, I was 14, I came to Munich and started attending the Ohel Jakob School. I thought I was in paradise. At last I was at a Jewish school and had friends. I'd been completely alone for the previous few years in this cheap children's home in the Odenwald where I'd come from. Nobody spoke with me anymore. Nobody wanted to sit next to me. I applied not to have to go on school outings. The others wore Hitler Youth uniforms and didn't want to walk alongside me. But the teacher wouldn't excuse me, and I had to tail along behind them all.
My father enjoyed playing skat, and our caretaker played skat once a week and used to invite my father round. The caretaker's son-in-law lived in the same block. He was a chimney sweep and fire department volunteer, but he had no telephone. So he asked my father if the fire department could call him if something happened, and my father said okay. On November 9th, 1938, the fire department called. We were to tell the caretaker's son-in-law that the synagogue in Herzog Rudolf Straße was on fire. My father thought it was a normal fire and he alerted the son-in-law. Then he woke me and told me the synagogue next to my school was on fire. I got on my bike and cycled over. After I had been there for about 1 hour watching, two SA men came up and asked me if I were Jewish. I said yes. They arrested me and put me in jail. I was just 15 at the time and had to spend the night at Edtstraße. Next morning, they released me. I went back to the synagogue to fetch my bike. Meanwhile, my father had heard what had happened and had gone out looking for me. At the synagogue, I saw my father standing there. I was about to go up to him when he was arrested. I cycled home quickly and told my mother what had happened. 4 weeks passed before my father was released from Dachau. Of course, he had to shut down the bed linen business that he'd run from home.
The Jewish school was in Herzog Rudolf Straße. an extension of the Orthodox synagogue that was burnt down in the pogrom night. The school building had also suffered serious damage, and repair work was forbidden. The neighboring building, number one, the Jewish kindergarten and nursery, was then used as a school. We went to school there until fall 1941. On November 20th, 1941, the first Munich deportation took place. After that, there were maybe 30 children and two teachers at the school in Munich. The majority had been deported.
We didn't know where they were being taken, and above all, we didn't know what would happen to them. After liberation, we then learned that this first deportation of 1,000 Munich citizens were all shot in Kaunas on November 25th. They didn't have a chance. No one survived. Then there were only 23 children in the home in Antonienstraße. In spring 1942, more children were deported from the home, so that now only 13 were left. The children's home was closed down, and the children and two carers, Jacobi and Bendix, were taken to the Jews' camp at Milbertshofen on April 11, 1942.
A total of 44 deportation trains with 3,666 victims departed from Munich. Their destinations were Kaunas, Piaski, Theresienstadt and Auschwitz.
The order for my deportation arrived on July 18th, 1942. The sender address was the Israelite community. I came home and there was the letter, a yellow letter, on the floor. It was pretty detailed. The date for my departure was fixed for July 22nd. The van that took me from my apartment to the detention camp in Knorrstraße had no windows. One couldn't look out and no one could see in. That was likely the point. The van kept stopping. New people were brought from their homes and put in with us. When we arrived in the camp, we were promptly robbed. There were two rooms. In the first one, you had to wait. In the second, you had to produce your papers. Two women were seated in the second room. They went through my luggage. One of my clearest memories is of these women who checked, or better, pilfered our luggage. One of them noticed I was wearing a gold ring and said, "Give me that," as if she just wanted to take a look at it, but then she kept it. The other, who wasn't quite so bad, found a little Reklam book I had with me, Goethe's Faust. She showed it to her colleague as if to say, "Look at who we're locking up or sending away here." I could keep the book. I'd had a pair of boots made so as to be prepared for come what would. The women kept them, also my loaden coat. So in Munich we had already been robbed. Before the journey had begun, the luggage we were allowed to take to Theresienstadt, which was anyway limited, had been considerably lightened. We spent one night in the barracks at Knorrstraße 148, dressed, sitting rather than lying, men and women in the same room. We talked a bit. Next morning, we were driven in a closed furniture van to Holzkirchen station, the southwest part of Central Station. That's where the trains for Theresienstadt left from. The platform had been cleared, but people were watching us with binoculars from the house windows. We were put in compartments with facing rows of seats, 8 or 10 people in each. We were told not to put our heads out of the windows, or else we would be shot. They'd taken our cases and told us we would get them back on arrival. We never saw them again. Everything was taken. I had to sign saying that I forfeited to the German Reich everything I'd left behind in Munich. And we were designated criminals. That was at the station. We had to sign and were given it, so it was clear from the start that we were criminals. We arrived at Bauschwitz station. The old and sick from the previous trainload were still there, lying in the mud, waiting to be fetched. We walked to Theresienstadt. We were led through the town with the hand luggage we still had. Where was the old people's home and the hospital they'd promised us? It was unbelievable. Where were the clean houses, where each person was meant to have their own furnished room? We were taken to our quarter. They couldn't expect us to live here. It was a hovel in a backyard. The hovel contained nothing. No furniture, heating, stove, just the floor, a roof, and rags hanging from the walls. A stinking compost heap was steaming in the boiling midday sun out in the yard. Our camp existence had begun.
Journal of the Deutscher Ärztebund, Association of German Physicians, 1938. Rats, bugs and fleas are phenomena of nature no less than Jews and gypsies. Life is a perpetual struggle. Therefore, we must start rooting out all of these vermin, and that means today. By means of protective custody and sterilization laws, we must change living conditions so fundamentally that all of these enemies of the Volk are slowly but surely eliminated from the stock that is fit for breeding.
The Jews who had been arrested and thrown out of their apartments were taken to the transit camp at Knollstraße 148. And from there, they were deported to concentration camps and death camps. The Jews from Munich and surroundings who were selected for deportation had to report to the transit camp. They never came out again. Once they were in, that was it. The camp was used until fall 1942. There were 18 huts, a latrine, a laundry, a canteen, a perimeter fence. There was a gate. The prisoners only passed through the gate when they went out to do forced labor at Lohhof or when they were deported. Our parents were allowed to visit occasionally, but they weren't allowed in. They had to stand outside the gate. I was 12 at the time, my brother 9, and my sister was not yet 4. There were 13 of us children, of different ages, without any organized supervision. School pretty much ended there. We still had a teacher, Herr Kessler, who came out to Milbertshofen. He applied for a bicycle so that he could come out to us at the camp, but it wasn't approved, and so lessons ended. But then, in summer 1942, a new regulation was passed saying that Jews in the German Reich were forbidden to attend school.
The ideology of the Nazis was the inequality of men. The growing discrimination led to increasing demoralization. People who have simply been neighbors for years are suddenly Jews, are no longer respected by friends, and non-Jewish children no longer play with their children. Then they have to leave their apartments and live in filthy huts in Milbertshofen. A week earlier, they still had an apartment with wardrobe, carpets, curtains. I can still see the people arriving in open trucks with mattresses, bundles, coats, sometimes with a fur collar, sometimes wearing jewelry. All that was taken from them. We were there for a long time because we weren't deported, but the others were only there for a few days or weeks, then they were taken away. When the camp at Milbertshofen was closed down, the remaining inmates were transferred to the home for Jews at Berg am Laim. The building was in Clemens Auguststraße, now St. Michaelstraße. It was part of the convent of the Merciful Sisters that the nuns had had to vacate. It wasn't like in Milbertshofen, because we came in contact with the nuns and could talk to them. We weren't allowed out, but it was a different atmosphere. And Jewish festivals were celebrated. But the Jews were deported to Theresienstadt in batches, mostly about 50 at a time. In March 1943, the few remaining children and inmates were able to leave the home for Jews Berg am Laim. We were allowed to return to our parents, who sublet two rooms in Damenstiftstraße.
Life from a fifth grade biology textbook, 1942. While colored peoples generally live far away from us and their bodily differences underline their distinctness, other potential dangers for our folk from racial mixing lie much closer. Foreign racial elements are involved here, which, although their skins are light, are spiritually very different from our race. The term Aryan is used to denote the racial components of predominantly Nordic influence, characteristic of the entire German folk. A person is of Aryan extraction if he is free of other foreign stock or blood. Apart from Jews, all the native races of the non-European continents, including Gypsies, are foreign. Aryan extraction is a precondition for all professions in the civil service, law of April 7, 1933, for attorneys, solicitors, patent attorneys, druggists, for doctors, dentists, and dental technicians accredited with the statutory health insurance companies, for the armed forces, community service work, and the NSDAP.
I was with my father the whole time because I wasn't allowed to go to school. As a painter decorator, he had a hand cart loaded with buckets and ladders. I helped push the cart and assisted him, but that didn't last long. Because of the heavy air bombardments, decorators were obliged to become glaziers. Of course, I had to wear the star then, but my father said, "You're not wearing stars." And when I was with him, I didn't wear it. But when I went on errands, I wore the star. At the very end of Adelsreiterstraße, the last building on the left at Zenettiplatz was Nause, with a sign that said, "Number 1 NS Store." When I went shopping there, every customer knew I was a Jew. We only had the restricted food ration cards with the big J stamped on them. Then we were bombed out of Damenstiftstraße and had nowhere to go. We were able to sleep in a classroom at the Anger Convent until Father found something else. And then a nun at the Anger Convent, Sister Laurentine, gave my brother and me schooling for 6 months. Near Central Station, at the corner of Luisenstraße and Elisenstraße, is the Luisen High School, and there's an empty lot opposite. Today there's a sculpture there, but back then there was an air raid shelter underneath. Once there was an air raid warning, I wanted to go down there. I was wearing the star. I was out in town. I wasn't locked indoors. But they didn't let the Jew boy in. The old botanical garden is a stone's throw away, and I hid under a shrub, crying. I was scared. Bombs were falling left and right. You mustn't forget that every park bench in the old botanical garden carried a notice saying, "Prohibited for Jews." These visual impressions still haunt me today. And the display windows at Conan's, for example, who deny it all today, Jews not admitted. This exclusion everywhere, feeling that you don't belong, that you're unwanted. Our mother was conscripted to work in a flax factory in Lohhof. Then she did homework for Maria Brettschneider's hat factory. That was easier for her. She had three sisters who'd married Jewish men and had children. All these uncles and aunts and cousins were deported in 1942, and none returned. Only Grandma, who was in Theresienstadt for 3 years, survived. That was the atmosphere then. The subject of talk in our family was, are we too going to be deported? We hoped the Nazis would be defeated in the Soviet Union. We listened to Radio Moscow and BBC, but especially Radio Moscow. Radio Moscow also broadcast in German, and there was a special signature melody too. I likely sing or hum that tune on my deathbed. Vaterland, kein Feind soll dich gefährden. And we cheered every defeat of the German armed forces. Stalingrad gave us strength and hope.
The licensee of a grocery store in Geltinger Straße has been sentenced by the Munich Municipal Court to a month in prison after giving bread to foreign civilian laborers without ration tickets for several months. A German worker who threw a loaf of bread into a tram car full of French prisoners of war has been sentenced to 3 months in prison by Munich Municipal Court. A 62-year-old widow received a 3-month prison sentence for throwing bread ration tickets to a Russian prisoner of war at Maximilianplatz.
The Nazis began building a subway in Sonnenstraße with the aid of Soviet forced laborers. My father and I went to them frequently and gave them food from the little that we had. It sounds trivial today, but when I think about it, if we'd been caught, who knows what the heck would have happened. Our father just didn't think about the danger he was undergoing doing certain things. He was stubborn in his way.
When I was 14, I was conscripted to work. I worked in an armaments factory at Tassiloplatz. They made telephones and batteries for the armaments industry. Today it belongs to Rode & Schwarz. It's the same building, but it's been modernized. The Wittelsbach Palais, on the other hand, the ruins could have been rebuilt, was instantly blown up just to make sure nothing remained. It was a 3-quarter-hour walk to where I did enforced labor. We weren't permitted to take the tram, but at work, we cut a star out of sheet copper, then stuck the yellow star made of fabric on the one side and a pin on the other. In the morning, I left the house, turned the first corner, took the thing off, put it in my pocket, and caught the tram. My father told me not to wear the star anymore. Simply to get on the tram and get off again. And then, one day, the local branch leader for East Munich visited the factory, an SA man. He inspected the lockers. On opening mine, he saw there was no star on my coat. He sent for me and asked why I wasn't wearing a star. My father had told me that if anything happened, I was to say he had forbidden it. So that's what I said. A few days later, my father was summoned to the Wittelsbach Palais. It wasn't the first time. They advised him to get divorced. The children would be looked after, they said. After that, I was more careful. But soon there were no more trams running anyway, because everything had been wrecked.
People in Munich used to say, "Keep your mouth shut or you'll end up in Dachau." This enforced silence told one quite a lot. For instance, that Dachau was certainly no sanatorium. Now and then you would see concentration camp inmates who had to defuse unexploded bombs or fill in bomb craters after air raids.
The terrible thing was that these inmates from Dachau were the ones who had to defuse the bombs. I saw it happen a few times. The police stood at a safe distance, and the prisoners, first of all, had to listen using a pipe to see if the bomb was ticking. If it was, they knew it wasn't a dud and that it would go off. My mother received a so-called induction order. These things always came a fortnight in advance. Subject: work duty. She was to bring a blanket and provisions for a few days, all food ration tickets, etc. She was to appear on February 20th, 1945, at the Wittelsbach Palais in Brienner-Straße. Oddly typed on the reverse were the words, "All children with luggage must also be brought for workplace-related relocation of domicile." The night before, I walked to Schwabing to fetch the Jewish doctor, because my mother was in bed suffering from heavy flu. I still have the original medical certificate here, where the doctor says she's confined to bed and can't get up. The next day, I took the certificate to the Gestapo at the Wittelsbach Palais. A certain Grimm was on duty. He read the certificate and then wrote on it in red, "Abgelehnt." Refused. Then our parents decided we wouldn't go. Early next morning, an official from the Wittelsbach Palais came to fetch us. He saw my mother was in bed and turned to go, saying, "Stay in bed." He was sympathetic. "I see you can't get up." A few hours later, a Gestapo officer and the link man between the Bavarian Jews and the Gestapo arrived to fetch us. We walked over debris and wreckage from Mathildenstraße to Brienner-Straße, my mother with fever. One of the two officers carried the case. We entered the Wittelsbach Palais, the entrance was in Türkenstraße, and were taken down to the cellar. We were there for several hours until everyone had arrived. No one knew where they planned to take us. A roll call of names was read out before we set off, but the names of us three children weren't on the list. We thought we'd be allowed to go home, but they said, "You're staying here." It was the same when we arrived in Theresienstadt. Our names weren't on the list there either. When it was dark, we were told we would be walking to Central Station, under guard. We were the only children. My sister was the youngest, she was 6 at the time. Otherwise, there were adults and adolescents, boys and girls of 17 and 18. We knew most of them. And then we were told to cover our stars so that people on the street didn't see. At Central Station, there was a Reichsbahn rail car waiting at the platform to the right in the main building. I was 14 and I had never been outside of Munich. My nose was pressed up against the window. Looking back, for me personally, a certain curiosity was mixed in with my fear at our unknown destination. At Furt im Wald, the car was hitched up to another train. We stopped in Prague for a night and were wretchedly cold. We could at last fetch water at the station. While we were doing that, my brother and I could have fled. But where to? Where could two boys of 14 and 12 have gone? Who could we have turned to? Our mother was still in the train with our little sister. There was nothing particularly exciting about our journey. There were three guards, SS, who were easygoing with us Jews. They told us we were heading for Theresienstadt. The 50 Reichsmarks I had been allowed to take with me were confiscated on arrival, as my fare.
I recall a lot of agitation among the 50 deportees. They were agitated because at some stage we were told we had to take a shower. Some already knew what showering could mean. What I also remember is how some people took out food before handing over their things. They were afraid it would be taken from them. My memories here are very murky, unpleasant, and fearful. My mother, sister, brother, and I were in Theresienstadt. We were there when it was liberated early in May 1945. We had to stay in Theresienstadt on account of a typhoid epidemic. Not until June 26 were we driven back to Munich on two open trucks. A reception office had been set up in Kaulbachstraße. Today there's a Jewish old people's home there, and Father was waiting for us. We were allocated a former Nazi's apartment at Kirchenstraße 21 near Max Weber Platz. After 1945, we were as poor as before, materially speaking. It was a very difficult time. Our parents were mental wrecks, and during the Nazi era, my father's customers had dwindled. The municipal authorities wouldn't take him on, for example. Looking back on it, that's inexplicable. The general mood in Munich was, we've lost the war, we're glad the war's over because the bombing's over. I began attending school again. I always took the tram to the Schwanthaler school. Riding the tram after 1945 was a nightmare. They were packed full and the grill doors were open. Then there were coupons. With coupons, you could only travel at certain times. I made myself an armband on which I wrote K.L. Theresien, Theresienstadt Concentration Camp. I wanted people in the tram to ask me about it. I wanted to tell people what I, with my 13 years, had been through. But people weren't interested. No one reacted. At school, to begin with, I was the filthy Jew again. And when I got into a fight, boys would shout, "Smack the Jew!" But things got better. I was fairly good at math and composition, but not at spelling. I was one of the best at composition. As a result, I was well placed in class. When an essay of mine was read out, Herr Wunder, the head teacher, would say, "Take a good look at Ernst. He never went to school, and he's showing you how to do it. Follow his example." That was how Herr Wunder commented my story without going into it more deeply. The fact was, though, that in these first decades after the founding of the Federal Republic, the recent past wasn't talked about. After 1945, our parents joined the KPD, the Communist Party of Germany. With few exceptions, they were all communist survivors. They met in a freethinkers' meeting house in Neubiberg. It still exists. And there, at the age of 13, I experienced for the first time that there were people who were willing to listen to me. And so I, too, began moving in this political direction. I learned the trade from my father and became an independent painter-decorator with a small business in Untermenzing. My father had taught me the necessity of political organization, and early on I joined the Youth Union and the Free German Youth, which also existed in the Federal Republic then. So I grew up surrounded by these issues and by recent history: rearmament, armed forces, peace treaty. We fought against the 10-year statute of limitations for offenses and crimes. That was in 1955. We held demonstrations, distributed leaflets. One wasn't so much angry with the man on the street as with those whose political decision it had been, those who wanted this statute of limitations. There was a Hans Globke, for example, who, among other things, had helped work on the Nuremberg laws, or Theodor Oberländer, who had taken part in the Hitler putsch in 1923, or the former NSDAP member Kurt Georg Kiesinger, etc., etc., who all attained office and honors again in the Federal Republic. There were these staff continuities between the Third Reich and the Federal Republic. I feel far angrier today at the lack of interest and denial of history on the part of a large section of society than I felt then against the man on the street. These days, they don't lock you up anymore, but they lock you out.